Hello and welcome to the As Yet Unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 16th of July 2017. My name's TRP Watson and this week I'm joined by Franco Milazzo, Gareth James and Alice from Traffic Light Theatre Goa. We're now going to talk about Queen Anne at the Theatre Royal Haymarket. This is the RSC production, which they did a year or so ago up in Stratford upon Avon, with a slight cast change. I mean, I think they've had one or two people changing the cast. It still stars Emma Cunniff as Queen Anne, but they have replaced Natasha McElhone as Sarah Churchill with Romola Garai taking over the part. Other people to point out in the cast, which is very large, are James Garnon, who plays Robert Harley, a sort of a very ambitious Speaker of the House. Richard Hope plays Sidney Godolphin, who was a very powerful Whig financier. And really, I actually first heard of him because years ago they did a dramatised documentary type thing about the Act of Union, which is covered in this because this is Queen Anne. She's early 18th century monarch, comes to the throne in 1703, and the Act of Union is in 1707. So this is covered by this play, and Godolphin was essentially the Prime Minister at the time, although they didn't start calling them Prime Ministers until the 20th century, but the post of sort of First Lord of the Treasury, which became Prime Minister, wasn't really established until Robert Walpole some years later, in the reign of George I. And we also have Beth Park as Abigail Hill, who is the cousin of Sarah Churchill, who becomes a closer confidant of the Queen Anne than Sarah Churchill ever was. I mean, this is the real force of this play is this relationship between Queen Anne and Sarah Churchill. They were brought together as children. They were sort of made to play together and live together and things like that when they were very young. And Sarah Churchill was a little bit older than, I think, Princess Anne, as she was then. And their relationship was very close. This play suggests that it was quite possibly sexual, or at least there was movements towards being sexual, certainly from Queen Anne's point of view. Although I think Sarah Churchill didn't much appreciate it, but she did enjoy the idea of sort of the power that it gave her. She made a very fortunate marriage with John Churchill, who later became Lord Marlborough, the Duke of Marlborough, and he was the greatest British general at the time, and the greatest English general at the time, when we were fighting things like the Spanish War of Succession in the early 18th century. This is the war that basically the Spanish royal family had become so inbred and freakish. There are some very frightening paintings of the later Philips, if you want to have nightmares about some of these kings around then. They look very, very strange, because they went round marrying their nieces and cousins and very close cousins. And that kind of proves that it's never a good idea to have so much inbreeding in the aristocracy and in royal families. So basically they, you know, ran out of heirs, and the French wanted to impose their king, and everybody else wanted to impose another king onto Spain. So we get these ideas of people trying to vie for power with this new queen. They haven't had a queen since Elizabeth I, and Anne looks at first to be a very weak woman and very much under the thumb of Sarah Churchill. This is parodied quite a lot. We get some, I think they're using original satires and bawdy songs that were written at the time. And we have a couple of rather interesting and well-known writers from that period: Daniel Defoe, played by Carl Priekop, and Jonathan Swift, played by Johnny Glynn, who write and perform songs and bawdy sketches to display the relationship between Sarah Churchill and Queen Anne, and how Sarah Churchill is in charge, and possibly suggesting sexual relationships either between Sarah Churchill and Queen Anne, or between Queen Anne and Abigail Hill, who later makes another fortunate marriage and becomes Lady Masham. At first, when we meet Abigail Hill, she is trying to get an appointment with another cousin of hers, who happens to be Robert Harley, the Speaker of the House. She's also, as I said, the cousin of Sarah Churchill on another side of her family. And she is able to get a relatively lowly position as a sort of, almost as Queen Anne's or Princess Anne's chambermaid. as she gains the confidence of the Queen, she becomes a much, much more important figure and begins to edge Sarah Churchill out. And it's also that Sarah Churchill is overstepping the mark. She is much more glamorous and much more forceful and has a much more open personality than Queen Anne. Queen Anne is painfully shy. She's also suffering from all kinds of medical problems, not the least of it, she's been pregnant, I think it's 17 times. It's something frightening like that. It takes a toll on you, even though only a few of those children are born alive. Mostly she's having miscarriages, but even the children born alive, none of them survive that long. I mean, the oldest one, I think, dies at the age of 11. She had a really terrible time, and the problem was that she was trying to produce a male heir. Otherwise, it may go to the Catholic side. She was the daughter of James II by Anne Hyde. She was therefore one of his Protestant children. James II was deposed in the Glorious Revolution because he'd married a Catholic woman and she'd given birth to a son, and therefore many people thought he should be king. He was known as the old pretender. Well, he was known as the pretender at the time this is written, but there was a younger pretender later on in Bonnie Prince Charlie. But this other James, who some people regard as James III of England and Scotland, James III of England anyway, people wanted to put him and James II back on the throne, but that would have meant a Catholic monarchy, which most people didn't want. And one of the people who really didn't want it was Sarah Churchill, who was, well, we're looking at Whigs and Tories, which they make a lot of jokes about, and there are a few Brexit jokes, as you would expect in a play written today. But we do get this idea of Sarah Churchill being a very Whig, very anti-Catholicism, anti-papacy, as they keep saying, and fearing that the Tories would quite happily have James II and his son back. His son becomes, you know, James III, as I said. And she fears that. And you have this idea of fighting against the papists. Now, actually, one papist, I believe, was Jonathan Swift. So you can see that is the sort of thing he's fighting against. That this Tories, these old established landowners and conservatives perhaps wanting this Catholic king to come back and hoping that they can deal with that rather than do something else. So what we're getting here is a very fascinating piece of history, and I think that that's part of the problem with this play. It's nicely performed. It's written by Helen Edmondson, directed by Natalie Abrahami, and with a set and costume design by Hannah Clark. And we get a very claustrophobic wood-panelled space at the Theatre Royal Haymarket. But I think that although it is, you know, well done, there are lots of really interesting people in this cast that I would have liked to have seen shine more. I mean, we get a lot of the three principal women, which is great, but, you know, there's lots of interesting other characters who don't really get a chance to shine. I mean, I suppose James Garnon does, but then he always does whenever he's on in anything. So, yeah, it felt a little bit too much of a history lesson for me, and that really rather undermined it. I mean, I usually am the first to complain when they don't get the history right in a play, but in this case, you kind of felt that every single word that is uttered by anybody was actually uttered by person, and they have two separate sources to prove that these words were actually used at some point by these characters. It's a little bit too much history. You want it slightly looser, but still true. And I feel a little bit of a hypocrite for criticizing it for being overly historical when I'm usually so down on people when they get the history wrong. What do you think about it, Franco?
So, as you put, this is a fascinating piece of history. A lot went on. I think they tried to cover too much in one play. I think they tried to cover it in too many different styles. So we had political drama, a bit of a lesbian romance. We had wartime drama. We had cabaret. We had all sorts of things going on. And sometimes it's nice to have variety, but in this case, it didn't really keep the flow going. Sometimes I felt like it was breaking up and you're never really sure what's coming next, or indeed what the point of the whole play was. I mean, are we talking about looking at individual characters, or are we meant to pull out and look at the state of England at this point, trying to extrapolate between the different religions? So there was a lot going on, and I just felt it just diffused a bit. The writing was also a bit uneven, so that you had some parts which were absolute zingers and other parts which were just exposition heavy. So I enjoyed it. Some of the performances were great. Emma Cunniff was fantastic in her role, showing an amazing amount of vulnerability. But Romola Garai, she was good, but nothing's really sparked for me. Nothing. Up until the end, there's a very a lot of pathos thrown in. Up until the end, she was good in her role, showed in a decent amount of range, but nothing really fascinating, nothing that I would come back for.
I did feel rather disappointed by this in many ways. I mean, it was nothing wrong, you know, really with the production, but as you say, too exposition heavy, too much explanation, too much very accurate history, and not enough taking freedom, taking a certain amount of liberties with historical facts in order to produce a more coherent play. It's a bit too, as you say, a bit too messy, a bit too many styles.
So it's worth noting that in recent times we've had things like Wharf Hall on TV, we've had the Crown. So people do know what a good royal bio looks like, and this wasn't one of them.
I also thought of Ink, James Graham's play, which is very, very historically accurate, but also very, not of course about the royals, but about the sun, but he captured the history very well, but also made a very entertaining play. We're now going to talk about The Tempest at the Barbican Theatre. This is the RSC's production, which they've brought into London. It stars Simon Russell Beale as Prospero, with Mark Quartley as Ariel, Joe Dixon as Caliban, and Jenny Rainsford as Miranda. This play also has special effects by Imaginarium Studios, who create characters. This is Andy Serkis's mob, I believe, who specialise in things like performance capture, which they use to some effect, especially when they are creating various aspects of Ariel on stage. Gareth, tell me more about this production and what you thought of it.
Well, they are making a big deal of the cutting-edge technology. I mean, they bill it as the Royal Shakespeare Company in collaboration with Intel and in association with the Imaginarium Studio. So, I mean, they are making a big deal of this. And I was kind of a bit concerned that the technology might actually swamp the play, but I didn't actually think that happened, because I felt that the contrast between the spectacle and the sort of more quiet reflection or quieter reflective moments actually was brought a kind of quite a fresh interpretation to it. There's this giant ship's hull, a kind of a wreck of a ship's hull that dominates the Barbican stage, an enormous sort of structure, and it all happens inside that, with projections onto the back wall and onto the hull itself. And I thought Stephen Brimstone Lewis had created an extraordinary environment, really, for that. And all of the, you know, Prospero, Miranda and the royals, they're all kind of normal human beings, as it were. Caliban is a kind of, well, I couldn't get Shrek out of my head when I looked at Caliban, but he's a kind of more of a sort of monster creature, and I thought brilliantly brought to life by Joe Dixon. And then the technology thing is really about Ariel, because Ariel is an onstage character who is, you know, again, brilliantly played by Mark Quartley in a very athletic performance. But also, he, in addition to being a character, an actor, he's also multiple digital projections using this performance capture technology that we've seen in films like The Lord of the Rings for Gollum and in Planet of the Apes. And as you say, Andy Serkis is now the master of this and is a director of the company Imaginarium, who helped the RSC here with that. And then we've got two brilliant characterizations of the drunks, as it were, Stefano and Trinculo, with James Hayes, and I thought very, very much more so Simon Trindu, who I thought was absolutely superb. And I thought, you know, the Caliban, the Stefano and Trinculo and Ariel were amongst the best I've seen. But I think it did make the royals seem all a bit dull, frankly. These giant projections on the back wall and on the ship's hull do create a lot of spectacle. But actually, the spectacle doesn't swamp the play, because it's spectacle when it's needed in those scenes. And if anything, the more reflective moments when Prospero is speaking are actually probably even more introspective than I remember them to be, quite sort of restrained. I thought it was a very gentle performance by Simon Russell Beale, which at first I thought was maybe a bit too restrained. But actually, then you realise that you are kind of hanging on to every word. And then also you realise that you can't hear a pin drop in the theatre, despite on the night I went, a profusion of school parties. And then you realise actually the contrast between the two actually seems to enable the verse to shine through even more. I enjoyed it very much. I thought it was a nice combination of technology and, you know, state-of-the-art technology and 400-year-old writing. And I thought it worked very well. I mean, there's, In addition to the other things we talked about, there's some great lighting by Simon Spencer and Paul English B has produced some quite evocative music, and I think that all kind of added into the cocktail. So it's something I was glad I went to see and I enjoyed. Alice, what did you think?
I'm a little bit at odds with you, Gareth. I felt that it was a very clear, straightforward production. I did feel that the special effects swamped it a little bit. I mean, obviously, the Barbican, like the Olivier, is a big stage and it has to be filled. And it is very, very worthwhile experimenting with digital effects. But at the same time, I did feel that it interrupted slightly the rhythm of the play, so that it gave me the impression, and I think it's totally unfair, that some of the performances seemed at times a little bit over emphatic because of the breaking up of the rhythm. I have to say as well, I feel that although the island, I mean, for those who don't know the play, of course, Prospero has been exiled with his daughter. Well, not actually exiled, he was overthrown from his own kingdom and ends up on this island with his daughter. I did feel that Prospero brings magic to the island, although there is a bit of, obviously, a bit of magic beforehand because there was a witch on the island and her son, who is Caliban. But I didn't really have the impression then that Prospero was really bringing magic. At the same time, Simon Russell Beale did a performance that actually grew on me. At first, like you, I wasn't quite sure. And then his sort of frazzled, juggling many balls in the air, Prospero, really came in its own. And by the end, it was very, very touching. And I think it was a brilliant, brilliant performance by Mark Quartley as Ariel. I think he was truly uncanny and thoughtful. And you could see him as a kind of bond servant who was trying to free himself and thinking which way he had to go, but was very, very gentle. And it was enormously affecting. Caliban, I wasn't sure at first. I think it was the costuming. I wasn't entirely sure about it. But then by the end, again, absolutely came into its own. There was a real dignity and beauty about the performance by the end. And of course, you had the feisty Miranda, who, by Jenny Rainsford, kind of impatient and straining at the leash. And there was a great sight gag as well with that. But I have to say, I felt that the special effects, it was an experiment. I felt it was it made it a very busy production. And it's worth doing. It probably would be great on the broadcast. I'm not sure about it, whether they quite got the balance right yet for the stage.
I think that this is a production that's always going to be measured from the outset by its production values and by its acting, but more by its production values. And in some ways, I think I agree with both of you in different ways. So, yes, the visual aspects were absolutely entrancing in places, absolutely gorgeous. They enhanced the play for me. They made it a lot more vivid. I'll be honest, Tempest is not going to be my favourite Shakespeare by a distance, but it made it far more than palatable. But there was such a wide range. So visually, amazing. But some of the costuming, for example, for Caliban, was desperately poor. And when I looked at Caliban, I thought, who's this Doctor Who extra has just walked on? The costume was absolutely terrible for it. But then again, the sound design also was pretty poor. Some places, especially at the beginning, I strained to hear exactly what the words that were saying. I knew what they were saying, but I really couldn't make it out. Partly because, as you say, it was a huge set. It's a massive set from top to bottom. And when they stood towards the top or towards the sides, I was sitting towards the middle. It was sometimes particularly hard to hear what they were saying. Acting from top to bottom was fairly good. It was also very, very good, especially Simon Russell Beale, who really brought out the pain and anguish and at the end of it, the joy of Prospero. And also the depth of character that sometimes doesn't leap off the page. The way that he brings the nuances to his acting is amazing. It's just a masterclass to watch. Other than that, yeah, that's fine.
I haven't got much to add other than this is the second time I've seen Simon Russell Beale in a Tempest. 24 years ago, 1993, he did it at the RSC. But that time he was playing Ariel in a Mao suit, and a rather strange and rather static aerial compared to this one, I think. But that was against Alec McCowan as Prospero and David Troughton giving a really excellent Caliban in that production. It also featured James Hayes, who of course is Stefano in this production, but he was the King of Naples' brother in that production. So it's an interesting, you know, contact between those two plays 20 years apart, and we are beginning to see this. I mean, we saw, the first thing I ever saw Simon Ross Beale in was King Lear, where I think he played Edgar, and recently we've seen him play King Lear at the National Theatre. So we're getting sort of these plays 25, you know, almost 25 years later, we're getting Simon Russell Beale sort of going from the young parts in Shakespeare to playing the old parts in Shakespeare, which I find rather fascinating. But as you say, it's a decent production, but yeah, there are some questionable costumes, and the effects I found rather impressive. I was sitting in the wrong place to really appreciate them, but they were impressive, and they didn't overwhelm the play. We're now going to talk about King Kong at the Vaults. This is a comic interpretation of the famous King Kong story, and is written by Daniel Clarkson, who co-created Potted Potter. So we're probably not going to be looking at a major piece of theatrical spectacular with an 80-foot-tall ape. We are probably only talking about something along the lines of plays that we've seen, like, say, The 39 Steps, or indeed Potted Potter. This play is directed by Owen Lewis, and hopefully they bring us the eighth wonder of the world in the vaults. Alice, can you tell me more about this and what you thought about it?
Yes, well, of course, the film is iconic, and I suppose now the special effects of the film do look a little bit creaky, but they still work. This is obviously a parody, and I thought it was nicely done. It's not particularly long. I think it's about an hour or so, and it's a parody of really all the King Kong films combined. You don't look for great intellectual depth in this kind of thing. It's a lot of kind of airplane style, if people know the old airplane films. It's this kind of airplane style farce comedy combined with some a very clever design by, I think, Simon Scullion, which is a bit like, I mean, I think I described it as an Art Deco toast rack. And so that the characters pop up and down in between, and some very good props as well. I won't spoil exactly how they do King Kong, but I think it was funny. You laughed at the way they were doing the props. There was a lot of energy in the production. I wouldn't say it's very, very original. I think maybe, although I never saw Potted Potter, that particular show caught a zeitgeist when there hadn't really been any or many parodies of Harry Potter. And obviously there've been an awful lot of King Kong. I'm old enough to remember the old Goodies episode where they had a giant cat going up the post office tower. I think all the actors did very well. I think some of the jokes went on a little bit too long, but you expect that in this kind of pantomime type of show. You don't mind it. You join in the spirit of the show. Most of the jokes did land, and there was some running jokes about the movie business and quite an extended bit of cannibalism going on with, again, very, very clever props. But they managed to make cannibalism funny, which is a feat in itself. I just thought, yeah, it was fine to pass the time of day with the family. You know, it's good, clean fun. And it was well done. It could have been honed a bit more. It was a bit ragged at times. And as I say, some of the gags went on a little bit too long. But enjoyable, enjoyable. What did you think, Franco?
I don't really like to disagree, but there's a lot in there which I thought was just much, much worse than your painting. It was, firstly, it's billed as a comedy, which I think the Trade Description Act, which is someone who's just step in and say no, because a lot of the gags just did not land for me, especially the running gag about the chap coming back alive. That was ripped straight out of Spinal Tap, and it wasn't even funny the first time around. The acting, Rob Crouch, I saw him do his one-man Olivier, And he was phenomenal in that. He is a bundle of energy. Here, though, everybody acts over the top, so it's hard to tell what is good acting and what is just like straight out of RADA or worse. So it was, acting-wise, apart from Rob Crouch, I would say, like, fairly poor. Writing-wise, I mean, it's somewhere between CBBC and The Goodies, as you mentioned. It's not good. I mean, at least The Goodies, in retrospect, we think, you know, at least we must have laughed back then because they got extra series. But here, I'm just watching with, like, a pale face going, this must get funny at some point. It is a comedy after all. But no, it is pretty much trying to inject laughs into the 1933 original script and failing miserably. The set design, I have to say, was very good. Especially the puppeteering. As you pointed out, the cannibalism part was, you know, that was quite chucklesome. I quite enjoyed that. But that's about 3-4 minutes within a 90-minute show. Generally, it was really poor for me. I mean, I went with somebody and I felt I had to apologize to them, saying, like, this is not something which I think is off standard in modern theatre, especially when you've got a decent cast and looks like decent money behind it. A director who has got some background to who, you know, who has done other things like Potted Potter. But yeah, set design was good, puppeteering was good, rest of it I could quite happily leave behind or just push face first into a grinder. It wasn't a good play.
I think I would defend it a little bit, because I think it didn't set out to be a great play. It set out, I think, to be an entertainment, as you say, for an hour and a half, an hour or so. As I said, I think Potted Potter, it was newer than this King Kong. There were times when I thought that the proto-feminist character, the girl, they're old jokes. Yes, they were old jokes, but a lot of them did work. I just felt as if some of them, just like with you, it needed a twist. It shouldn't have gone on and on. Like the token guy, you needed a twist at the end. He was a fellow who seemed to bounce back umpteen times like a rubber ball. And you just needed something a little bit different at the end. In that way, it felt a bit like a computer game sometimes than a fully formed play. But it was undemanding entertainment for me. And maybe I'm just a big kid, but it made me chuckle.
You're perfectly entitled to chuckle. It just didn't work for me. That's all I'm saying.
No, of course.
We're now going to talk about Bat Out of Hell, the musical, which is at the Coliseum, usually part of the ENO. This is a musical based on Jim Steinman's classic album sung by Meatloaf, Bat Out of Hell, and there are actually, I think, by now 3 Bat Out of Hell albums, parts 1, 2, and 3. But the classic album sold, I think, about 43 million copies, and almost everybody these days knows the songs. This is, by the look of it, is a rather ambitious jukebox musical with an awful lot of staging and a Romeo and Juliet setting. We have Strat, played by Adrian Polak, who is the head of the Lost People who live on the streets, and he falls in love with Raven, played by Christina Bennington, who lives in a high-rise tower with the other rich people, and it is sort of their coming together. And we get an awful lot of the music and some very ambitious staging. I have seen talk about, you know, the idea of Neverland, Jem Barry, Peter Pan, that kind of thing. In this, with the Tribe of the Lost, led by Strat, who are, you know, trying to make their way in the world. Now, Franco, can you tell me more about this production, what you thought of it?
It's staged, it's important to say, in the Coliseum, one of the grandest venues in all of London, home to the English National Opera. And it does seem initially strange that you would see, as you say, a jukebox musical, which it plainly is, within such a grand setting. But it works. It adapts to the setting. We have some phenomenal set design, which sees motorbikes running across the stage. We have a car which crashes almost into the orchestral pit, which results in the conductor and one of his musicians standing up and getting on stage and walking off in disgust, mock disgust, but still. It was a very good adaptation to the venue, which I thought. The main downside to me was that unless you knew Bat Out of Hell number 2 and number 3, then there'll be a lot of times that you'll just be sitting there waiting for the next song to come along. But when a song comes on that you do know, my lord, the place jumps up. It's like a church. It's a cathedral. Everyone starts singing. Everyone knows the words. And there's an energy which I have to say, for a lot of V&O productions, just isn't there. Whereas when you watch opera in there, it's quite a po-faced experience. We watch, we listen, we walk home. With here, a lot of people singing, a lot of people almost, I think, standing up and dancing in places. And it is an electric atmosphere when a song comes on that you know. Otherwise, it is kind of just sitting down waiting for the next song to come along.
It's not a show that I would see twice, but seeing it once, it's a show that I would say is an experience. That's with a capital A and a capital E. I think it's true that I was waiting for the songs to come along. And it's spectacular in the literal sense of the word. Just brilliant, brilliant performers, I have to say. I mean, you couldn't fault the singing at all. I think it's Andrew Potlack as Strat. And as you say, Christine Bennington as Raven, but also the parents, the wicked parents who've created this corporation, which has created this dystopia with the kind of Lost Boys as an outlaw gang who are just trying to keep up their heavy metal kind of biker culture down below the skyscraper. It didn't really have that much of a story. It felt like an amalgam of a lot of jukebox musicals that have gone before, but it was very well done. I have to say, it is very, very, very loud. It was blasting through the cupola of the Colosseum because, of course, it is microphoned, and this is a more or less, I think, a purpose-built building for singing. And obviously it became very, very loud. I was, you know, I wasn't in the stalls. And in a way, I thank my lucky stars I wasn't, because I think my ears may have been a bit blasted then. But, you know, for a lot of people, that would be part of the attraction. I thought the visuals were incredible. I think the choreography, I think some might think it's stilted, others might think it's kitsch. It really depends on your point of view. It wasn't that original, as I say, in terms of the story. And I just felt sometimes it may have drawn on other concept albums, the kind of stories that were, even the name Raven may have been, I felt like it could have been a reference to kind of an Edgar Allan Poe, which has been done as a concept album by others. But of course, the songs are incredible, and they really hold the show together along with the amazing performances. And I think I should also mention Danielle Steers, who played Zahara, who is the kind of spy for the gang up in the luxury tower where Raven, the daughter, is kept by, is overprotected by her parents who rule this dystopia. I mean, she was pretty amazing, actually, and very clear. And at times, the sound wasn't as clear as it could have been because it was just blasting out. But that was part of the experience. And I think overall, it was well directed and it was, as I've said, spectacular.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azeta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com, and the podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you, goodbye.